So notice the just the state of mind, the mental quality you're experiencing now, like having breakfast, talking, so forth, that stimulates, stirs up the mind. And now the opportunity to just observe that, it's like this, just notice this. Without trying to do anything about it, but witness it. The sense of the having eaten breakfast, talked to people, result is like this. So you're just noticing the way it is. It's not a matter of approving or disapproving or thing, but of just noticing this awakened state where there's awareness, but it's not critical, but it's intelligent. It knows the way it is, but it's not making any kind of comments about it in terms of if it's how it should or shouldn't be, but it's just noticing that this is the way it is. And then this attitude of welcoming, rather than being caught up in the habit pattern of trying to control or get rid of or try to attain some kind of mental state that you remember having. Like one of the problems that people have is that they remember having blissful experiences, samadhi experiences on retreats, and then they have this memory, and then they when they meditate they want to have this experience again. So that they try to make it happen maybe by trying to suppress thinking or control everything. Because they're still desire something that they don't have, that they remember having once, that they liked it, and they want it again. So being aware of this also, this awareness includes all everything. It's not saying there's anything wrong with this, you know, like want it again. So being aware of this also, this awareness includes all everything. It's not saying there's anything wrong with this, you know, like you shouldn't desire anything. You should sit here and not have any desires, that's how you should be. And then that's coming from an ideal again, of, you know, of an ideal is how things should be. But we're not operating from comparing the reality of this moment with an ideal, but awakening and accepting and welcoming the way it is, even if we don't like the way it is. Not a matter of liking it, but of learning to welcome even what you don't like and don't want. So I mean, I developed this welcoming practice years ago, and because I'm such a person that finds welcoming certain mental states very difficult, and certain things I don't like, certain mental states, and I habitually reject and try to get rid of. So I can see, you know, my own characteristic when something I don't, certain mental states very difficult, and certain things I don't like, certain mental states, and I habitually reject and try to get rid of. When something I don't like and don't want, I push it away. I have this sense of just pushing everything away from me because I don't want it. And this, I could see it in reflecting on this. I actually had this sense, I just saw myself doing this to life, kind of. this was my, what do you call this, approach to life, or? The approach was to not let it approach. So then the sense of welcoming is occurred to me as a way of remembering how to, you know, not to, to, because this was so habitual, it wasn't even intentional. You know, it wasn't like I was intending to do this. It was a force of habit. The intention is now, say, to welcome even what I don't like, don't want, unpleasant mental states or difficult situations or whatever, whether it's internal or external. Or in terms of metta practice, in the Buddhist terminologies, we in Theravada we have this word metta, loving kindness. And metta is welcoming everything. It's not divisive. It's not critical. When you know you're developing this metta, it's toward everything in the universe. So you have metta for the devils, the demons, the angels, the enemy, the friend, the enemy, the good and the bad, the mosquitoes, the flies, the germs, the birds, the precious little kittens and the beloved doggies and everything. No preference, you know, you're not even saying, I want 90% metta to go. And only about 1.1% to the demons. You're not being picky about it either. It's totally welcoming conditioned phenomena for what it is. From the whole range, from the heaven to hell, from the best to the worst. So what does this do, you know, when you know, the effect on your mind when you start developing this attitude of metta, is that it counterbalances your critical tendency, doesn't it? Because your critical mind will exclude things, you know, this is better. This is how it should be. This person I approve of. This one I don't. There shouldn't be these evil people. There shouldn't be criminals. There shouldn't be pedophiles. There shouldn't be this and that. There should be only this and not that. Then you're caught in your own personal preferences and weighing one thing against another. But metta is not critical in any way. But it's certainly aware, you know, it's not being idealistic. It's not like you're supposed to generate a kind of loving quality towards everything in the sense of liking it or approving of it. Like metta isn't meaning you like something, because liking depends on conditions. The conditions have to be in such a way that you like this. When the conditions aren't this way, then you don't like this. So that's just the way it is. But in this sense of metta, or unconditioned love, then it's not a matter of our own personal preference, liking or approving, but of this welcoming, accepting, a kind of generosity, uncritical acceptance of the whole range, of the whole, all phenomena, in whatever form it takes. So to be able to do this, you know, first you start with yourself. You start with the kind of formula that we have is, may I abide in well-being. So we have this formula, and then the first is always directed towards yourself. So it's learning to accept yourself for what you are, the way you are. And that means welcoming and accepting everything, your dark side, your good side, your bright side, your stupid side, your evil side, whatever, or learning to accept uncritically even the things you most don't like about yourself. And this is, I found, the most difficult for me, because my critical faculties aren't all that rampant turning outward, but they tend to go into a tirade when they turn inward. So don't worry, I'm more critical of myself than of any of you. So this "may I abide in well-being" is a reminder of well-being, wishing this being well, you know, having respect for this condition, this human body, this person with its habits, its emotions, whatever they might be, whatever way they are. So this sense of welcoming even your dark side or your foolish side or your pathetic side or despair or fear and anxiety, worry, rather than endlessly trying to think that you've got to get rid of them because there's a resistance, like, I shouldn't be this way, I shouldn't feel like this. What you'd like to be and the way you are is not near that ideal. The way it is now, even if it's very unpleasant, the sense of it's all right, welcoming, rather than proliferating about how can I get rid of these bad habits? How can I change? How can I improve myself? And endlessly try to come from that critical mind which wants to deny or get rid of or annihilate what you think is bad, evil, wrong, foolish, stupid. So metta allows all these things, because they belong, you know. These are not, there's nothing, everything belongs in this moment. Contemplate this. Because it's here, it's like this. And then if I come in and say, this shouldn't be here, then that's me, that's my own personal sense of, you know, I don't want this here, I shouldn't be here. But actually, the reality of the moment is, because it's here, it belongs. One thing I used to always find living in Asia, a sense of belonging, even though I'm an obvious foreigner. And this used to baffle me, because I've lived in India and in Malaysia and in Thailand. And in all those countries, I've always felt more at home, like I belong. I don't belong in one way. I'm so big and, you know, big white man, and living in a forest monastery, all these little Thai monks. And, you know, I'm out of place. I'm an anachronism. I'm a foreigner, you know, in terms of of the appearance. But on an emotional level, I felt at home. And then I began to recognize that the one thing that many of us like about Asia is that they do have this sense that everything belongs. You know, lepers, mad people. I mean, they have this total acceptance of that whatever it is, if you're deformed or diseased or beautiful or ugly or rich or poor or high caste or low caste, I mean, you all have just as much right to be here as any, because you're here, then you belong. So metta then is like this, it's this sense of being at home, being allowing and accepting and being patient with what you don't like and don't want, what you find irritating and disgusting and revolting or whatever, learning to not be lost in just following these reactions, but in learning to be patient and accepting and welcoming even the dark side of your experience. That takes patience, doesn't it? Because for me, developing patience, because emotionally I'm conditioned to try to push it away, to get rid of it. then the good side, learning to welcome that without demanding it. When there's happiness present, is you welcome it, but you allow it to arise and cease. You're letting things be what they are, rather than you trying to hold on to what you like and get rid of what you don't like. And to be able to do that takes this attentiveness, this butto, this still point, the sense of pure presence, which includes the all that is right now. I was talking this morning to somebody about grief, and this of course is an emotion that we all experience. In the West, we tend to not know how to deal with it, or think that it's an indulgence, a kind of making a lot out of nothing, because we can be quite rational about it. We think it's dismissing what you're feeling. And I see this a lot, and I can see this in myself, how before I did practice meditation, how much I would just, when I feel grief, how I just tended to dismiss it, because it seemed more noble to say, get on with life, you know. Just get on with it, you know. Don't make a scene. That seemed noble in a way, you know. Not to sit around crying and weeping and making everybody feel terrible, and just get on with life. But in doing that, that's an ideal, and it seems noble, but at the same time, you're not respecting what you are feeling. You know, you're merely trying to push it aside. And so in awareness, we are willing to grieve, which is not indulging in grief. It's not holding on and just wallowing in grief and feeling sorry for yourself or that. But it's a willingness to allow this emotion to be conscious and respecting it, because it's a natural kind of emotional experience. And when the Buddha pointed to dukkha as the first noble truth, well, part of, you know, when he says old age, sickness, death, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish, and grief is the first noble truth. You know, it's not like it raising it from an emotion that you may feel even embarrassed about or just want to get rid of, to the first noble truth. So then this is like then welcoming this grief, because it's like a noble truth rather than some kind of personal weakness. So put it in that context, where, and to understand grief, isn't it? To understand dukkha or the first noble truth, this is one of the insights, is dukkha should be understood, or grief should be understood. To understand that you have to accept it. If you're just reacting, pushing, well, you can't understand anything if you're always reacting against it. You know, just your reactions are just to reject and push it away. You have no way to understand it. And so grief then is something to understand. And this then is a way of a welcoming, you know, this sense of welcoming, or this metta. Grief is something to welcome rather than to reject or ignore. So from this still point, then, like grief, when you feel this sense of loss or separation from the loved, it's just, you know, in sense of noting, it's like this. It feels like this. What does it feel like here? You can go to your body itself. Does it feel here, in the lower part or in the heart? Now I notice around, this is my own experience, as I open to people in the present, I actually feel a kind of, like this the doors that have been closed here are opening. This is my own personal sign. I used to think I had a heart. Because people kept talking about heartfelt feelings, and I kept trying to think, I don't think I have one, you know. And I felt such a kind of up in the head type person. I never really was very much aware of what I was feeling. And so trying to be aware on the level of the heart was, I had to put forth an effort to do that. And it's not a strong resistance because my rational mind sounds pretty soppy to me. Very critical, isn't it? It's a tendency to, it sounds emotional and weak and I didn't like, and I didn't want to identify myself in that way. When I contemplate this, I've had this sense of like there's doors that kind of let open. And I find this very real in when I'm in this still point, and I'm with somebody directly, you know, really, even with this group, this sense of that there is a heart relationship. I can feel a sense of an openness in this area, which is an intuitive feeling. I don't think you could measure it with scientific instruments, but it's the best I can do to describe the experience. I notice when I go into critical mode of reactivity, then it seems like the door's closed, because then I'm up in the old patterns of where you don't feel anything. Because when you're caught in your thinking, you don't really feel very much. You know, thinking has no sensitivity. That's why people that think all the time, oftentimes, are very insensitive, because they live in a world, rational world, that is quite beautiful, you know, in its own way. But there's no feeling there, and so it's like opening to sensitivity isn't trying to say I should be sensitive, but it's recognizing the realm that we're living in is like this. That it's not an ideal realm. It's not the perfect place. It's not how things should be according to what is the ideals of what is the best, what is fair, what is just, what is perfect. This realm, things change. So fairness isn't going to always be what we're experiencing or how or what should be or shouldn't be. Even the atrocities, the serial killers, the wars, the unfairness, the tyrannies, as well as the justice and the fairness and the goodness, they all belong in this realm. No matter how much we try to make life into a Garden of Eden, it also we're embracing along with it the forces of our own destruction and the destruction of the garden itself. Because that's the way it is. It's not because there's anything wrong. So what are we supposed to learn from this? You ask yourself. I mean, this is obviously something to learn from, isn't it? Because if this is the way it is, you know, if it's my fault, then maybe I should do something, go to a shaman to exorcise the snakes in my mind. You know, that's one way of looking. You know, the idea that it's my fault, but it's not, isn't it? This is seeing the Dhamma. The Buddha pointed to the Dhamma, which includes all inclusive. So, just contemplating like this, I find suddenly I'm more interested in life because I it doesn't seem like an endless a kind of struggle with everything, where on a personal level, when I was operating from how things should be, it seemed like life was just always a kind of a struggle for me. I was never going to win this battle. because as much as I, you know, tried to control and make things good and make myself what I thought I should be, there was this other side that had been rejected and denied, and it would inevitably keep pounding in my consciousness, you know, keep demanding attention, taking it all very personally, and then feeling very useless and hopeless, and even a sense of maybe I shouldn't be here, you know, I don't belong here. So in terms of taking refuge in the Dhamma, then we are beginning to, just like the awakened, the sense of awakening the Bhutto and noticing the way it is. And this, I think, was one of Lungpa Cha's great gifts. Was in Thailand, for example, the Thais do have an acceptance of life that the Americans don't have. And so, and Lungpa Cha wasn't idealistic in terms of, you know, you should be in this idealized monk, you know, this perfect bhikkhu that, you know, always kind, always unselfish. He would find very amusing our weaknesses, our mistakes, our how we would take ourselves seriously and how we would deny our humanity, getting us to look at the absurdity of our expectations, of trying to make ourselves into something that we can never achieve. Awareness, then, is, with a Buddhist monastic reflection, always just noticing the way it is, the way your body is, for one thing, the way your mental state is. And it's just awareness, embracing, welcoming, noticing, but non-critical. So it's certainly alert and awake and intelligent. It's not a kind of passive, a negative acceptance of life through resignation to fate or whatever, but it's a very alert, awakened, alive sense of being and being able to expand to where what before you denied and rejected, you include, you start including and opening. And so this comes through awareness, and then this awareness includes everything in this moment. Even your feeling that it shouldn't be like this, it includes that. You know, there's nothing you can think, say, or do that doesn't belong at this moment. And no matter how complicated your thought processes might be, they still belong. As well as your body in whatever state it's in, or your emotional state, whether you feel successful and happy or you're feeling depressed and a failure, it all belongs. So then there's this sense of, oh, what a relief. I don't have to endlessly purify myself and try to make myself better all the time. I can actually maybe rest a bit, relax, trust. So I find that, what a relief, you know. That I don't have to do anything anymore. What'll I do if I don't have to do anything? But not having to do anything, I mean, then if we grasp that as something, then it becomes absurd also. But it's a reflective statement rather than an ideal you're holding to. That I'm now don't have to do anything, then you attach to that, and that becomes an ideal again. But I'm trying to use language more for reflection rather than for positioning, taking a position on anything. This sense of this, I've got to get something I don't have. What is that like? Be the observer of it, kind of welcoming this sense of, you know, I'm not good enough the way I am. I've got to make myself better. I've got to do something to improve myself. What is that like, you know, when you observe it as a mental state? You know, and how I feel, I just feel this incredible pushiness all the time. It's always pushing, you know, goading me on, and it doesn't, it just, and as long as I don't recognize it and don't see it in terms of Dhamma, it always is affecting everything I'm doing. Like it's a kind of underlying influence of how I experience life. You know, this sense of always there's something I have to get that I don't have. I'm incomplete, I'm imperfect, I'm not good enough. I've got to become enlightened. All this is like Bhava Dhanha in the Second Noble Truth, this desire to become. So it's the cause of suffering. When we grasp this Bhava Dhanha, then we experience dukkha. Vibhava Dhanha, where you have this feeling you've got to get rid of all kinds of things. You've got to get rid of greed. You're too greedy. And you've got to get rid of anger, because good people aren't angry. And got to get rid of jealousy. That's disgusting to be jealous. And I've got to conquer my fears, because a brave person is fearless. Got to get rid of... Isn't that? It's the Vipava Dhanha. I'm not good enough the way I am, because I'm greedy, I get angry, I'm jealous and frightened, and I've got to get rid of those emotions. But notice this attachment to what seems very good, you know, like in a logical mind, isn't it? We should purify the mind. We should free ourselves from these passions. These are imperatives in the holy life of having to purify and free ourselves from the lower realms, the passions, the selfishness. It's not that it's wrong, even, but it's just notice that attachment to that idea. This is what the Buddha's constantly pointing to, this upadana, this attachment. I've got to get rid of this. It's my problem, and I'll never be able to get enlightened as long as I have anger. Then the logic is I've got to get rid of them. And then that's upadana, attachment, because it's coming from the sense of I am this person, I am this body, these are my problems, and I shouldn't have them. They're what's blocking me from enlightenment. I've got to get rid of them. So the whole thing is based on delusion of I am this person. So this bhuto is transcending this personality view. Like when, that's why it embraces everything. It embraces your personality rather than judges it. And so this is like when you talk about the absolute subject rather than the personal subject. Like when you attach to your personality, then you become a personality and you interpret experience through the distortions of your personal habits. You see life through these distortions of your personality. And that's why it you know, as long as that illusion is not seen through, not realized and accepted, then we are always in this state of, you know, our personalities are, you know, we're going to be frightened, because personally, if I'm this human body and I'm this person, it's vulnerable, and I can be physically harmed, I can be emotionally humiliated. You know, all these things are so possible, and we've all experienced it in so many ways, being physically harmed or personally humiliated by experiences. And on a personal level, this is an ever-present possibility of being harmed in some way. Body's a very vulnerable state, and emotionally, you know, really damaged just through what somebody says or how somebody looks at it. So this is taking all this personally, then it is a very fraught situation that we're living in. So learning to see this in terms of Dhamma from this bhuto or this still point is giving you a perspective on the way things are, in which you're developing wisdom rather than just reinforcing your personal view of everything. Because wisdom is a universal, it's not personal. It's not I'm wise. They can't claim it as some kind of personal attribute. But it certainly operates when we let go of the identity with the personality and the body. When we claim it on a personal level, then we call that spiritual defilement. Vipassanuba kilesas, the kilesas that come through insight practices. A lot of them are like you start interpreting, you know, I am an attained person. I am an arahant, or things like this. And these claiming these on a personal level is called vipassanuba kilesa, or defilement, spiritual defilement through insight. So that's why in bhikkhu discipline, they have very strict rules. Like if, you know, one of the disrobing rules, there's four disrobing rules, and one of them is if a bhikkhu claims high states that are not true in order to delude others or exploit others, then that he has to disrobe. But then if I happen to be deluded, but I have no bad intention, I just start telling people, you know, I'm now an arahant because I've had this experience, and then that's also an offense, I have to confess. Because sometimes you do. I've had experiences where I felt I'm enlightened. You know, through very, like, heavy concentration and whatnot, and I'm enlightened now. And then it's best not to say anything. Like Ajahn Chah would say, well, just keep quiet and practice a little more and it'll go away. So in this, even in Thailand, they people are, you know, always looking for arahants, and who is an arahant, who is a stream enterer, because there's such a strong desire to achieve and attain, and or to know whether somebody else, what their attainment is. So there's, you know, there's these people that as soon as somebody says they're enlightened, they run off to them, you know. One monk, I remember, years ago, claimed he was enlightened, and this was one of Ajahn Chah's disciples, and a whole lot of monks suddenly left Ajahn Chah because Ajahn Chah wasn't claiming anything. Because they wanted to be with an enlightened master, and then they became disappointed with him. We don't trust ourselves. We'd like to maybe put our trust in somebody that says they're enlightened. You get these people who are very confident, like some of these gurus that appear, you know, I am the Messiah or the Maitreya Buddha of this era, and people will flock to them because they're so confident, and their confidence has a kind of sparkle to it. It has a, you when you're really positive, you kind of have a radiant quality around you. And this positive thing is like the in Waco, Texas, remember a few years ago where the government went in and kind of annihilated them all. But when you read about that cult, you know, the leader was, is the craziest teaching and the most kind of obvious con artist. And he was totally convinced of his own enlightenment. So, I mean, this and that kind of confidence is very powerful. And because we don't trust ourselves, we will give ourselves to somebody who we think knows what they're doing. And this is where, when you're talking about Buddhism, the real essence of the Buddha's teaching is this awakenedness. The Buddha is saying, wake up, rather than, I am the Buddha, and you must believe in me. It's really an invitation, an encouragement to awaken. So that means you wake up, not depend on my waking up. and so, I mean, this is what, to me, very meaningful, because There's something, say, I remember in the beginning, a lack of trust. I did feel I'm not good enough. I'm a defiled person, a weak person who needs a strong teacher. And I need, and I can't trust myself, but I want to find somebody I can trust. So then this of course led me to somebody like Ajahn Chah. But then his whole emphasis was on waking me up rather than binding me to him. You know, so, I mean, he could see what I was doing, and he kept pointing out, you know, like when I say, you know, Ajahn Chah, I've been practicing how many years of. Am I a stream enterer? And he said, how do you expect me to know? So he's suddenly throwing me back on myself. You know, suddenly, you know, if you don't know, why do you think I should know? And whenever I would kind of lean on him in that way, but in a gentle way, I never felt he was. Like it wasn't like pushing me away, but awakening me to what I'm doing. My own kind of longing to depend on somebody because I think they're wise and I'm not. Mm-hmm. And where actually he was very effective in getting me to see what I was doing. But there was also a fear of taking responsibility for being wise myself. Because my personality says, don't you think you'll ever be wise, you know. My personality's got this tyrant, you see. So it says, you can't trust yourself, you know, you're a mess. You just got, you know, you think you're ever going to get wise, you know, and it would go on like this. So then I began to really see that this was, this inner tyrant was a habit. You know, it wasn't alive, it was a dead thing. Because it would say the same thing no matter what. It didn't have any, you know, it couldn't meet the situation. You know, no matter how good I was, I could never be good enough. And how successful I am, I could never be successful enough. No matter how strict I am with the Vinaya, I couldn't be strict enough. And no matter, you know, people say, oh, Ajahn Sumedho, that was a really good talk you gave, and the inner tyrant said, no, it wasn't. So no matter what, you know, no matter how much the world came forth and said, you know, and said, you know, you're really good, you're really wise, you're really, you know, the best, the inner tyrant would say, you're not. And then I realized, by recognizing that this was a habit, it seemed alive, but it wasn't. It was just some reactive, that the button you press, you know, so it just goes like that, and it would say the same thing no matter what was happening. I can't believe that, because it doesn't have any wisdom or any. It's dead. It's nothing. It's just a. You know, you push this button and it goes, you're not good enough. Push it again, you're not good enough. Push it again, you're not good enough. And that's all it can say. So don't believe it. You know? Don't give it any ground in your consciousness. Then contemplating this, I am not good enough the way I am. I need to practice in order to become enlightened in the future. Now this is a sense of me as a person, has got to do something now in order to become something in the future. You see, so it's based all on delusion. This kind of sense of me having to do something in order to become enlightened in the future. So because it's, for one thing, eternity is now. You know, the future is the unknown when you contemplate the present moment, isn't it? What is tomorrow, right now? is what you don't know. You can speculate, guess, and whatnot, but these are all taking place now. The past is what you remember. So you remember yesterday or 10 years ago. Then it's a memory that arises in the present. I am of this person is an assumption I make, isn't it? It's like a personality is really, when you observe your personality, it changes according to conditions. So you personally change into, you know, on how your personality manifests according to the conditions you're in, whether you're with friends or enemies or with your parents or with your husband or wife or with your colleagues, whether you're alone, whether you're in the monastery, the summer school. I mean, your personality changes accordingly because that's the way it is. It adapts itself to the particular conditions present. But yet we can assume, we have this assumption, I'm this person all the time. But what you're actually doing is creating these assumptions and never questioning, never looking into what you're doing. So the awakened awareness allows us to see this. When we rest in this butto, or this pure state of being, listening, attention, then we begin to see the personality, how changeable, how ephemeral it is, and how it depends, you know, what the conditions are for it to be happy or sad or ebullient or depressed or feeling bored or feeling fulfilled, feeling accepted or feeling rejected. But this awareness transcends those personality conditions. And so this awareness is a constant factor where the personality is very, you know, ephemeral. So you begin to see that you can't trust your personality as your identity. It's not what you are, even though it says so and it seems like it. You're breaking out of that limitation through this awareness, getting not rejecting, not trying to not have any personality, because that's impossible. But no longer being committed to the personality as yourself, because you're really limiting yourself all the time by doing that. You know, you're binding yourself to oftentimes very unpleasant limitations that you just habitually caught in, you know, which you need. Once you see you can free yourself, you can let go. And your real identity then is in the awareness. And in this sense, then this attitude of welcoming, metta, and trusting in being in this state. And then learning from that. And you find you can accept and you can welcome even the most horrible things, the things you're most frightened of. Once you have trust in this practice, this way, you'll find that what you're most frightened of in dread, you've got space for that also. And that fear will drop away. So I'll stop here. We've got a few minutes for questions. Yes?
I find sometimes when I'm meditating, whether it's counting or mantras or whatever, suddenly a thought comes and you think, oh, this could be a shaft of enlightenment. And you think, no, I must carry on with the meditation. So you deal with it in one of various ways, either telling it to go away and you deal with the thought afterwards, or you just be with it and let it go. And I've tried these different things. And then you carry on with your meditation. When you finish, you think, right, now I'll get on and develop that thought that came to me. But you find when you've got as old as I have, you can't remember what it was. So what I would like to know is, if And when that happens, should I stop the meditation and develop that thought, or should I just send it away?
Well, just trust your own kind of intuition. You know, if you feel the thoughts interesting that you'd like to pursue it, go for it.
Thank you.
Yes?
I'm reading quite a lot about, you know, how to develop your full potential. And I'm very interested in developing my full potential. And then, and I like your reflection on what a full potential is. And then reading on the train to Leicester, Ajahn Chah's book, Our Real Home, I underlined one sentence which said, our real home is inner peace. And I thought, maybe that's my true potential. Am I being simplistic?
To me, the real home is in this stillness. Because that's, you know, when you begin to trust it, it's where you're at, where you can trust and relax, you can let go. Like a home is a place where you feel totally at ease and you don't have to protect yourself or defend yourself anymore. And so to me, this is it, because I can't find it anywhere else. And then a lot of like New Age ideas are, you know, they're, in some ways, they are encouraging us to step out beyond the boundaries we put on ourselves, because even on a kind of personal level. So because we've all, you know, we get a certain dose of conditioning from our family, our cultural background, and then that oftentimes is so powerful that it affects the rest of our lives. We never get beyond those limits. Or there are those of us who rebel and fight and try experiment and do all kinds of things because we found the limitations suffocating. And that can still be very egotistical and caught up into trying to realize my full potential, which, you know, sounds very attractive, as my ego tends to think, you know, my full potential. And like you, I think, I wonder what that would be. If I were at my full potential, what would I be like? and then in the reflective mode of meditation, then that full potential would be in this state of peace or stillness. Because that's where things arise, you know, then you're no longer limited by, or you don't have to just recondition yourself to be bigger and better and brighter and more intelligent. And I mean, this, the way of the ego interprets full potential is you've got to make yourself into a better person, a more interesting person, a successful person, you know, somebody that is on top of everything, who's grand and so forth. And then, but you know, even if you can do that, you know, you eventually get old and you shrivel up. you can't sustain it. When we trust in an intuitive approach to life, we tend to realize a perfection intuitively. But as an ideal, it just makes us critical. Like, so you idealize perfection. You know, you have, you're like putting everything at its very best, peak moments. When everything is what is as it should be, and because we can create superlatives in concept, and we can inspire ourselves in through dwelling on, you know, thinking in with superlative adjectives and it kind of uplifts and inspires, but then But then the other side is that we can go the other way. We can just get depressed where everything is meaningless and ugly and life has no point and everybody's selfish and on like this, because the thinking mind is dualistic and so it tends to create, if it creates one thing, then its opposite also goes along with that. And that's why it's so easy for very idealistic people to become depressed, because they go to one extreme and then they easily fall into the opposite one. Because they can't, you know, they're blinded by their ideas, their ideals. And then in terms of your own experience of life, you know, you're not an ideal. You know, you're this human body. We can idealize a human body. We create a kind of ideal human body. So we have these kind of images of the ideal feminine form, ideal masculine form, and those are ideals. But then when we look at our own body, we think we see isn't near to that ideal. Then if we think of ourselves with vanity, then we become very critical of our own bodies. You know, we see them in terms of what's wrong or what doesn't is removed from what it should be according to the ideal. And so then we can become very hard on ourselves and hate ourselves because the imperfection. So we're far removed from what should be. And then just on a physical level or on an emotional level, like if you're high-minded person, you know, you want to be a loving, caring, intelligent member of society, and then you find out you're really full of anger and you're jealous and frightened and you hate everybody, and then you feel, you know, you shouldn't be like this, because the ideal person would be this bodhisattva type, you know, and you're not like that. So then you see yourself in terms that you become obsessed with how bad you are or inferior. So this is where and it just seems, no matter how hard you try, you know, basically I think like in, we were talking the other day about the Dalai Lama saying the Tibetans basically like themselves. I mean, that, or this morning saying how an American is brought up to always feel he has to justify that I'm here because I'm Ajahn Sumedho and I'm Ajahn Chah's chief foreign disciple and I'm, you know, I give my qualifications and that gives me the right to be here. but just because of the fact that I'm here, does that give me the right to be here, you know? And this is what I felt in Asia, is that basically they don't have so much of a problem with that. Like this sense of no matter who you are or what condition you're in, you have just as much right to be here as anyone else. And so this I think we tend to feel very uneasy with ourselves all the time. I notice this with the monks and nuns that I live with. There's such a lack of being at ease with yourself, of just being accepting and at ease with the way you are, rather, because very few can do this, because they're conditioned to feel they always should be trying to be something else. It's very powerful. It's obsessive compulsive. Thing. Yes?
I've read a lot during past years about the Dharma, so I decided I should go back to the original text, so I bought several kilos of the original Buddha Sutras, so God knows how I managed to take them back to Berlin. And I started reading them again, and I became aware of that there is a lot in it that again says a monk, a person should abandon this and should do that, or when you read the Dhammapada, it's very difficult to not to get caught up again in this, you should not. Are you aware of this when you read the Buddha Sutras?
Very much. they made me feel worse. I used to read, there's a book they used to read in Wat Naphong, the monastery I lived in with Ajahn Chah, and they were, and as I began to understand Thai, you know, at first I didn't understand what they were reading, so it didn't matter, but then when I, as my ability to understand Thai increased, then a lot of these were just this, what a good bhikkhu is, and it was very inspiring, because that those kind of teachings are inspiring ones, you know, of being unselfish and compassionate and so forth. So those are like, and then how I began to deal with this. Well, I see that the ideals are like a guiding star, you know. It's like a guiding star is up in the sky and it's far away, but it gives you your direction, you know, so you go in that direction, and you need to, you know, be aware of it. But if you just look up in the sky all the time, you're going to fall into the pit in front of you. so you also need to be aware of the limitations you're in right now, with, you know, with the looming hole right in front of you, and the wall that you have to, how do I get over this obstruction? And you can't do that if you're just looking up at the star, you know, and praying that it will, you know, lift you out over the obstruction. And so this is where the inspired forms are like a direction. And that they give us a direction to go toward, and then the mindfulness practices are bringing us down to the realities of the situation that we're in right now, with our own kind of emotional habits or environmental conditions. You know, I've noticed with some monks felt they couldn't be monks because they'd read those things, and it was so high-minded that, and they felt so intimidated and so worthless in comparison to these ideals. They think, oh, I don't think I can be a monk. And I'm not worthy of the... One monk used to say, I'm not worthy of the robe. You know, I shouldn't be wearing this robe. I'm not worthy of it. And then, as I said, the robe isn't saying that. You're saying that, aren't you? You know? My robe doesn't care whether I'm worthy or not.
When I'm in this sort of atmosphere, it feels like I'm in a big orchestra and we're all playing the same tune. The difficulty for me comes when I go back and away from this orchestra, and I find that where I'm living and in the people I live with and some of the people I work with, they're playing a completely different tune. And does that pass eventually, or is it just at the moment, because I'm fairly new to the practice, that I feel out of tune rather than I'm changing in some way that feels almost like a desertion of some of the people that I love. But I no longer, you know, the sort of things that I used to enjoy.
Well, it's like, this is one way of it, like growing up, isn't it? Like as a little child, I used to like to play in the sandbox and with little cars and build mountains and tunnels, and I could spend hours doing this, and then, as a year later, that's the last thing I wanted to do, because I outgrew it. and there was nothing wrong with it. It's not like a condemning playing in the sandbox, but It's like you outgrow it, and you can't go back. You can't play in the sandbox again like you did then. And like a spiritual development is, you're maturing spiritually, and so you can't go back to being, you won't ever be able to go back to that.
Yes.
I mean, because you don't have this, you're not the same person that was, that where you believed in it and you didn't question it and you kind of lived according to that style and enjoyed it even, but then something shifts and you change and you and this is something to respect in yourself. But sometimes it is makes you feel rather lonely because you are going off in a direction that maybe the others wouldn't understand yet, and or feel even threatened by.
And I was thinking, well, the week after I'll be going back to work, and then I have a vision of letting go and acceptance, and my in tray kind of piling up, my too difficult pile expanding. And I just find it very difficult to apply it right across my mind.
Well, like, this is where wisdom is necessary. Rather than holding on to the ideal of letting go, it's like when sometimes we have to hold on. But then trust yourself to know when that's appropriate, when it's not. When you have to do something, then, you know, like do your work, then really do go for it. You really, you know, don't try to be mindful and unattached to what your work. But just know this is a time to do this work, and then really do it, committed to it, concentrated on it. Then you begin to see also when you stop work, you just let it go. Don't carry it back home with you. There's this sense of knowing time and place, so that it doesn't, like mindfulness doesn't prevent us from being, doing like very concentrated things or, you know, worldly things that we have to do to live our lives. But it does free us from oftentimes the unacknowledged way we hold and carry and how we can do things half-heartedly. You know, what we are doing we can do just half-heartedly because our mind is somewhere else. And so that we aren't even doing a good job sometimes when we should be. And so I find that this attitude of mindfulness is using also punya or wisdom. So knowing time and place, when to concentrate, when to let go, when to hold on, when to let it go, when to say something, when not to. These are all quite, you have to, you know, trust your own intuition in this respect, because, you know, the flow of your life and the character that you have and the conditions you live with, you know, are unique to you, so you have to learn to trust your own judgment and intuition in the matter. That's where if you're just trapped in conditions, you just go around in it. That's why this awareness is the way, is the escape hatch. Because otherwise you're just stuck in this morass of churning conditions, and they just feed each other endlessly. And that's where, you know, the Buddha said there is the unborn. So there is escape from the born, you know. And so if there wasn't the unborn, there'd be no escape. You'd be stuck in the kind of hell realm of this churning wheel, you know. You couldn't get to the still point. You'd just be out on this endless revolution of stuff going on. But as you awaken, then you're in the still point. And that's your real home. That's what you can trust. It is a it's a reality, so it's to be realized. It's real, so it's not like a kind of abstract ideal. But that reality is here and now. And so it's so present that we can't find it as an object. We have to be it. We have to be this reality. Be this being Buddha, or being Bhutto, or being the knowing, being awake. And then the inner tyrants say, can you trust this, you know? You know, you've still got a lot of work to do, you know, you said something you shouldn't have yesterday, and you didn't act very well at that meeting. No, shut up. It's tea time.